on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us for Maryland Morning. We begin this morning with another installment in our monthly series, Living Questions, in which we examine the role of religion in the public sphere. The Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies is about to undergo a leadership transition. For nearly 30 years, Christopher Layton has led the charge to promote religious tolerance and understanding in Baltimore and beyond. Catholic scholar Heather Miller Rubens will take over as executive director next month. They're here along with Islamic scholar Humaira Ziad and Jewish scholar Benjamin Sachs to talk about what it'll take for the voices of tolerance to be heard in the din of bigotry that has taken over much of the public discourse in this unprecedented political year. Plus, a preview of the African American Festival, which hits Camden Yards this weekend, and J. Wynn Russick has her weekly theater review. First, the news.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Hope you had a good weekend. We begin this morning with another installment in our monthly series, Living Questions, in which we examine the role of religion in the public sphere. We're producing this series in partnership with the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies. The Institute is about to experience its first leadership transition since it was founded. Dr. Christopher Layton, who along with religious and business leaders in Baltimore started the Institute in 1987, he's stepping aside this month as the leader of the ICJS. Dr. Heather Miller Rubens, the Institute's Catholic scholar, will take over as executive director next month. Later on the program, we'll be joined by the Jewish and Muslim scholars at the ICJS. Now I'm pleased to welcome Christopher Layton and Heather Miller Rubens to Studio A. Good morning. Good to see you both.
Great to see you, Tom.
Thanks for having us.
And Chris, I remember when ICJS started because, as it turned out, your offices were right above mine at the Baltimore Choral Arts Society on Park Avenue in the office building of Brown Memorial Church. Your reflections as you take leave of this thing that you started as a pretty small operation back there in the mid-80s and has now grown into, I think, a thing that everybody can understand as a thing that's having quite an impact on the conversation about religious tolerance.
Well, it's quite remarkable that when we began, we had the expectation of going out of business as soon as we had raised everyone's consciousness. And the challenge that we hoped everyone would take on was the recognition that our religious traditions have this nasty habit of defining themselves over and against some other, that there is a kind of toxic habit in play in which we elevate ourselves at somebody else's expense. And we know that every religious tradition is forged in the fires of conflict, and that is very much the case with Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and Hinduism, Buddhism. I'm afraid there are no religious traditions that can claim themselves to be immune to that dynamic.
Why is that? Why are religions particularly susceptible to being forged in the context of crisis and oftentimes political conflict?
Well, this is a question that keeps many of us up late at night trying to unravel. In large measure, I think it's a sort of human proclivity, isn't it, for one group to try to differentiate or claim its distinctiveness. And in order to do that, there has to be an us and a them. But what oftentimes occurs is this more deadly move that the us gets glorified and the them gets demonized. And so the dynamic can very easily turn negative and become a polarizing force of opposition.
And Heather Miller Rubens, when the Institute was started, it was the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies, perhaps the most dramatic change or the dramatic, most dramatic direction that the Institute has chosen to take in these last couple of years is to add Islam as a very equal and major theme of the work that you're doing. What's that going to mean moving forward? You're going to be the one running the ship as that sort of gets, you know, completely codified and completely solidified in the work of the Institute. You hired Humaira Ziad a couple of years ago. She's a terrific person, a wonderful scholar. She'll be joining us here on the program in a few minutes. How do you see that dynamic, having an impact on the evolution of the Institute moving forward?
The inclusion of Islam was the culmination of a three-year process, which Krish and the board helmed. And so it's a wonderful opportunity for the organization to participate in the contemporary conversation. I think thinking back to the origins of the Institute, dealing with Jewish-Christian relations was incredibly important and remains incredibly important. But talking with Muslims and talking and learning about Islam is the conversation that needs to happen at the beginning of the 21st century.
Dr. Heather Miller-Rubens is the incoming executive director of the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies. Dr. Christopher Layton, the outgoing executive director of the ICJS. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. So, Chris, as you think back about what you've accomplished in these last 30-some years, what are the things that stand out? What are the things that you're most proud of and happy to see continue?
Well, Tom, when I first came to Baltimore 39 years ago, it was to function as the chaplain at the Gilman School, and the Baltimore Presbytery had questions about the legitimacy of my ministry. And so I had to go before a panel of ministers who then...
Because you are an ordained Presbyterian minister.
Yes.
Minister, right?
So they had to interrogate me to make sure that my ministry was legitimate. And there was one pastor who turned to me and said, well, I'm not sure if this makes a great deal of sense. My understanding is that the Christian presence at your school has been diluted by the influx of Jewish students. And I must say I was so taken aback that my response was rather curt. I said to him, if the Christian presence is so fragile it cannot withstand the presence of Jews, the Christian presence deserves to be shattered. And again, we've come such a ways in terms of recognizing that we are enriched and enhanced through the encounter with the other, that there's an enormous amount that Christians and Jews and Muslims have to learn from each other. And what I take greatest pride and satisfaction is that increasingly there are Christians, Jews, and Muslims who come to know their own traditions in a new way, come to recognize that their religious voices can invigorate the public conversation, it can enhance discourse that's essential for a democratic polity when they are able to mobilize the wisdom of their ancestors. And so the friendships that get forged and the quality of exchanges that take place are on a different level than they were when I arrived in Baltimore so many years ago, back when dinosaurs still roamed the
right,
globe.
Right. I remember those days. That's right. I was out there fighting off those dinosaurs with you. Heather, the work of the Institute in the city itself has also increased. It seems to me that the profile of the Institute here in Baltimore, particularly since last year's uprising, you have responded in very specific ways. Talk a little bit about what that response has entailed and what you think the capacity of religious organizations, religious traditions can be in addressing the multiple problems that were sort of laid bare in such a dramatic way after the violence last spring.
Yeah, so our organization, when the uprising happened last year, stopped and assessed where we are as an organization and what our role is in the city. And we're, as an organization, committed to the idea that interreligious learning and interreligious friendships are core to building a good civil society. And if we truly believe that, then we need to go into the city in a firm way. And we created the Imagining Justice in Baltimore initiative to do just that. And the core of the initiative is bringing together a group of 25 activists from around the city to have a conversation grounded in religious texts from Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, essentially having an inter-religious learning opportunity for these activists. And it's been an amazing experience for us to work with this particular constituency and also participate in the public conversations. We had three public lectures at the Reginald Lewis Museum over the winter and spring, bringing Jewish, Christian, and Muslim national scholars to Baltimore to reflect on how justice is understood within their traditions and then how justice could be applied to Baltimore. In the fall, we're going to have a citywide conversation where we want people from all around the city with a variety of commitments and affiliations to come together and to really take the opportunity to read and reflect and think about this sort of larger concept.
And the conversation so far, and excuse me, I don't mean to interrupt, but in these conversations so far, what are you finding? I mean, the fact that they are ecumenical, the fact that they are, fueled by the perspectives of different religious traditions, are you finding any common themes or any interesting points that you think can be helpful healing the city and moving the city forward?
I think that a theme that's emerged is the importance of love in the three traditions, and also the importance of knowing your neighbor in the three traditions. And the one thing I want to sort of emphasize is that we're not actually making a movement towards consensus, but we're sort of displaying what a robust commitment to religious pluralism looks like in the American context, which is more a sort of cacophony of commitments in the public square. And so the aim of the series is not to reach a sort of unified Abrahamic vision of justice in Baltimore, but to say that all of our traditions have a wealth of information on this topic, and we should be drawing on them as part of the larger puzzle that is Baltimore.
Yeah, and Chris, before we take a break for news and invite your colleagues Ben Sachs and Homaira Ziad in here, this notion of consensus is not central to what you're doing. You're not trying to get everybody to agree and you know, figure out every problem. You're just trying to make sure that folks understand the perspective of other people.
Absolutely. In large measure, we are trying to retrieve a practice, a discipline, articulated in the Jewish tradition as machloket, which just means a sacred argument, an argument which doesn't yield just winners and losers, but an argument in which one discovers that one's best teachers oftentimes prove to be those with whom one most passionately disagrees.
Yeah, and in a public discourse that is so often, you know, black, white, left, right, up, down, north, south, you're allowing for nuance, you know. That's a lousy idea, allowing for nuance. You should have bagged that years ago. All right, well, we'll come back with lots more after a break. Dr. Christopher Layton is the outgoing executive director of the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies. Dr. Heather Miller-Rubin's the incoming executive director of the ICJS. You're listening to our monthly series, Living Questions, in which we explore the role of religion in the public sphere. And after a break for news, we'll have more with Chris Layton and Heather Rubens, and we'll be joined by the Jewish and Islamic scholars at the ICJS, Benjamin Sachs and Homaira Ziad. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Here's Nathan.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WYPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
Good morning and welcome back. As the investigation into the mass shooting at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida continues, perhaps the only thing that's clear at this point is that the shooter was motivated by a toxic admixture of anger and bigotry, which may or may not have been exacerbated by self-loathing and an alleged allegiance to a wide range of often opposed terrorist organizations. Once again, as the sun rose over southern Florida 2 weeks ago, we were confronted with the possibility that these murders were carried out in the name of religion. If you're just joining us, we're talking this morning with the leadership team of the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies. Dr. Christopher Layton will retire as the Institute's executive director next week. Dr. Heather Miller-Rubens will succeed him in that role. Dr. Homaira Ziad is the Islamic scholar at the ICJS. Dr. Benjamin Sachs is the Jewish scholar. They're all here with me in Studio A for this month's edition of Living Questions, our look at religion and the public square. So Ben and Homaira, good morning and welcome to you guys. It's interesting to me, Ben, that when the Institute started, one of the issues was Christian anti-Semitism towards Jews. And it was something that the Institute has, you know, played a big role in developing a conversation about. And I'm proud to have been part of that conversation back in the 90s when the Baltimore Choral Arts Society did a performance of the St. Matthew Passion. We talked about religious intolerance in the Gospels and in the music of Bach and in Western art in general. So it's something that's certainly near and dear to my heart. But I wonder, now that we've added Islam to the mix of the Institute's work, do you find parallels between anti-Semitism and Islamophobia, which is now so much in people's consciousness?
I do see parallels, but we need to be clear that the history of anti-Semitism and the history of Islamophobia are very different. And the political contexts are very different, so that when we draw any type of analogy between the two, there are always going to be exceptions. That being said, I do see similarities, especially in the public square, where you have a lot more scholars writing about Islam who are not Muslim, and you also have a public excoriation of Muslims done by think tanks and politicians and journalists. And it's making its way into a public square in a way that's very similar to the way that anti-Semitism rose in Europe in the 19th century, that Sharia law, for instance, is apparently not compatible with Western values. We saw the same thing with Jewish law in the 19th century, that Jewish values were not in any way relatable to German values, et cetera. And so the one thing that we can learn moving forward at the Institute is that these moves have consequences. And when you feel compelled to paint an entire community with a single brush publicly and negatively, the consequences are usually violent. And it may not be violent now, but it will ultimately be violent when the language is based in violence.
And Homer Ziad, the Brexit vote, for example, in England, Washington Post reporting yesterday that after that referendum, a wave of racist incidents have taken place in Britain. British police recording a huge uptick in learning from social media and from people reporting and from police investigations around the country. It seems like there is an intensified reaction, an intensified, as Ben said, reaction that has led to violence already over this issue of immigration, over this issue of other, and in large part, it's centered in the Muslim community. Mm-hmm. Your thoughts about that?
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, we know that those who are rallying for the British exit were, in fact, fanning the flames of racism, fanning the flames of Islamophobia, and certainly focusing on an influx of immigrants that were coming from Muslim lands or Muslim-majority nations. And we see that happening here as well. So, for example, the politicians, Donald Trump just being the most egregious example, have been fanning the flames of Islamophobia by focusing on the hordes that are coming in from Muslim-majority nations to bring in a different set of values. And that really centers on this issue that these people are essentially different from us, that their value systems are incompatible with ours. And this it brings up all the tropes of traditional Islamophobia, which are that Islam and those who are call themselves Muslims are somehow essentially violent, essentially deceitful, essentially misogynist, essentially different from us, and that Islam is uniquely a religion of violence, uniquely a religion of misogyny, and that unlike other human beings, the dehumanizing aspect of Islamophobia is that unlike other human beings, Muslims are driven primarily by theological, religious, scriptural traditions, that they're not influenced in any way by what influences a normal human being, politics, economics, social status. All of these things are not present when Muslims act. So yes, we see these tropes playing out, especially in this conversation around immigration and the threat of immigration to the United States, which again is overblown considering how many refugees we've actually brought into the country, which is abysmally low compared to the rest of the world, which is taking in so many.
Dr. Homer Ziad is the Islamic scholar at the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies. Dr. Benjamin Sachs is the Jewish scholar. Heather Miller Rubens, the Catholic scholar. She's about to become the executive director. And Dr. Chris Layton is the outgoing executive director of the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Living Questions, our series on religion. So, Chris Layton, here's the rub. You're talking about tolerance. You're talking about understanding the other. You're talking about not building a consensus, but certainly building an appreciation for people with a different perspective. How does one incorporate this notion of tolerance when it comes to intolerant people? For example, if you're one of those many people who disagree strongly with Mr. Trump about his notion that, you know, building the wall and keeping Muslims out, and, you know, Mr. Cruz actually suggesting that we start, you know, with law enforcement monitoring Muslim communities in the United States. If you don't agree with that, if you think that that's morally repugnant, if you think that that's bad public policy, if you think that that's bad for the security of the United States, how does one then become, is one obliged to be tolerant in any way of that point of view?
Well, there's a saying that goes, in the face of stupidity, even the gods are helpless. And we buck against this whole question of breaking people out of their insularity, which is an insularity that enshrines stupidity and makes ignorance of a global force. In large measure, the ICJS is committed to being a venue where people come to know each other and don't simply become tolerant of each other, but again become so deeply entangled and enmeshed in traditions other than their own that they start to see the world in new and expanded terms. So the shifting of a culture, the shifting of a public conversation that moves people to a greater appreciation and understanding allows for the excitement of an adventure. One goes to different lands, one makes discovery of different people, and as a consequence of that, remaining within the isolated enclave feels suffocating. So our experience has been that people who are willing to travel into unfamiliar terrain quickly discover that the world is much bigger and more exciting, and the possibilities are far richer than they had ever imagined.
Yeah, and Heather Rubens, I mean, the conversations that you've been sponsoring, that you've been putting together, the people you've been convening, the topics you've been taking up over these last almost 30 years now, it really, in a certain sense, it's just as simple as that. I mean, I think about marriage equality, and when gay marriage became much more acceptable, it seemed to be the tipping point was that more gay people came out, which meant more straight people understood that they knew gay people, and they realized, oh, this is a person I've always liked, and now I've just found out that he or she is gay, therefore I don't have any trouble with same-sex marriage. Is it just that simple? If we just simply put the right folks in the room talking about the right things in a calm and civil way, we'll make progress one step at a time.
I believe so. I think that the unique genius of the ICJS is the recipe of knowledge plus relationships builds a sort of resilient community. And I think bringing people together, so combating Islamophobia, going back to our earlier conversation, having a conversation about what it means to be Sunni and Shia in isolation, and you're reading it on the internet or you're looking up something, that necessarily isn't going to diminish your fear of Islam or your Muslim neighbors. Bringing people together to have that conversation with Muslims in the room will do that work. And that's what we're committed to doing as an organization, education plus relationship building.
And Ben Sachs, as you have these conversations here in Baltimore, I mean, you can give folks the facts. For example, Mother Jones reports that there have been 49 mass shootings in the United States since September 11th, half of which have been carried out by white men. right? You can tell people those facts, that kind of thing, to say that this notion that, Islamic extremism or whatever it is, that whatever tag they want to put on it, is perhaps even in a sinister way overblown. But do the facts, have you found in these conversations that the facts are convincing people? What does it take to actually turn the heart and mind of a person who might be thinking that?
I'm not sure that I have the answer as to what turns the heart and mind of any one individual. When we do present facts to people, it does cause a pause. What usually happens is someone will disagree with the facts. That can't be true. But I think over time, when people are willing to address the fact that they're coming from a place of prejudice and not from a place of information, they're more amenable to it. But going back to Chris's point, sometimes the allure of any type of ideology or theology is so strong that even facts might not prevent people from continuing to think in a certain way. We invite those people to the Institute, but usually people who come and talk to us are interested in facts and information and less so about ideology and fear.
Yeah. And Homer, I'm going to give you the last word. We're running out of time. But Leon Wieseltier wrote in the Post, I think yesterday, about the compassion deficit that we have in this country and that we tend to be compassionate towards one group at the expense of another. He talks about the political discussion, saying now everybody's warmed up to the middle class. Let's forget about the poor. Is there a compassion deficit, and are there things that all organized religions can do to even that playing field?
Is there a compassion deficit toward a particular religious tradition, or in general?
I mean, is it always at the expense of another?
I certainly think that all our religious traditions have focused on compassion as a serious force for the cultivation of character and for creating links between religious traditions. I do feel that, again, this is very contextualized, but I do feel that, yes, we haven't spent as much attention in our public discourse around religion, in our religious spaces, focusing on what it really means to ethically be a Muslim, be a Christian, be a Jew, mm-hmm. and what it means to what kinds of exercises we can engage in.
And I'm sorry, I'm going to have to stop it there because we're out of time. But I do appreciate all of you coming in, and good luck, Chris, in your next chapter. And thanks for the continuing work that you guys do. Homer Ziad, Benjamin Sachs, Heather Miller-Rubens, and outgoing ICJS Executive Director Christopher Layton have been my guests for this edition of Living Questions, our monthly series on religion in the public sphere. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up a little later, a preview of the African American Festival. But first, it's time for our weekly look at the theater scene. For her weekly theater review this week, Maryland Morning theater critic J. Wynn Russick has been to the Olney Theater Center to catch their production of Andrew Lloyd Webber's classic, Evita.
Don't cry for me, Argentina.
If you didn't know that Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice wrote Evita 4 decades ago, you might think this musical about the role of celebrity in politics was brand new. The idea of a celebrity running for office is the overriding theme of Olney Theater Center's reimagined, eye-opening production of this musical look at the life of former Argentine First Lady, Eva Perón. Unlike director Harold Prince's original interpretation of the show as an examination of media manipulation, at Olney we see Evita manufacturing her own fame and using it to catapult her husband, Juan Perón, to the presidency. A microphone on a stand becomes a major prop in director Will Davis's inspired interpretation. Commandeer the mic, get into power, win over the people, as Evita does, and you can tell them just about anything. Christopher D'Amboise's marvelous choreography illustrates this from the start, giving the chorus stylized, often synchronized movements. The slick chorus members look like individuals, but they think and act like a single-minded mass. The crowd is so blinded by Evita, they let her get away with robbery, She literally picks their pockets. In the number and the money kept rolling in, she opens a suitcase and distributes cash to a circle of needy citizens. They pass it hand to hand until it winds up back in Evita's suitcase, a brilliant bit of choreographed storytelling. To chronicle Evita's calculated climb to fame, Rice and Lloyd Webber created an everyman narrator they called Che. From the original production on, Che has usually been portrayed as Che Guevara. But at Olney, Robert Ariza, in the production's best performance, offers a distinctive take on this character. Instead of playing him as the fully formed, mature Guevara, Ariza shows us the young man Che actually would have been at the start of Evita's rise. After witnessing the self-aggrandizing ascension of the Perones, it's not difficult to picture him radicalized into the archetypal revolutionary Guevara. Ariza also deepens this angry, cynical character by giving him some divided loyalties. Heated as his denunciation of Evita may be, he sheds a tear at her death at the end. That ending, by the way, is excessively quiet, perhaps too much of a whimper for the larger-than-life tale of the Perones. Ariza's singing is as strong and assured as his delivery of Che's sly commentary. In the Rainbow Tour number, he puts extra emphasis on his description of Evita as her husband's trump card. And he aces an added song, The Lady's Got Potential, a rock and roll number borrowed from the 1996 movie. If Rachel Zampelli's Evita were as complex as Ariza's Che, this would be an extraordinary revival. But as an opportunistic Argentine icon, Zampelli seems awfully all-American. In addition, her singing is frequently shrill, although she does justice to the show's signature song, Don't Cry for Me, Argentina. Nick Duckhart gives a solid performance as Juan Perone, but, possibly by design, there's not much chemistry between the Perones, at least not at the preview I attended. Even in their first presumably charged meeting, in the song I'd Be Surprisingly Good for You, we don't see their lust for each other, or even Evita's lust for him as her conduit to power. Scenic designer Arnolfo Maldonado situates all of the action in a ballroom under construction. As Evita's circumstances improve, the room gets chandeliers and fancy chairs. Why a ballroom? Perhaps because politics, image-making, and yes, celebrity, are all a dance. In this case, masterfully choreographed and startlingly fresh. In our current political climate, being famous, rallying crowds with big talk, and dancing around the issues appear to be enough to secure a presidential candidacy. Olney Theater Center's Evita doesn't just take artistic risks, it's also unsettlingly timely.
Theater critic J. Wynn Russick shares her thoughts on all things thespian every week here on Maryland Morning. Evita continues at the Olney Theater Center until July 24th. We've got more information on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Coming up a little later in the broadcast, a conversation with Shalonda Stokes, who's the mover and shaker behind the largest cultural festival on the East Coast. The annual African American Festival comes to Camden Yards this weekend. We'll have a preview right after the news. I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning. Stay with us.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now back to the show.
And good morning once again. Thanks for being with us on Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. This year, Baltimore's African American Festival turns 40. And to mark the celebration of music and culture, festival organizers are bringing in some huge names, folks like Common and Vivica Fox, for example. The festival takes place this weekend at Camden Yards. While music will be a big part of the fun, there'll also be interactive activities focusing on issues like health and wellness, financial literacy, and community and police relations. All events at the festival are free. Shalonda Stokes joins me to talk about what you can expect and what went into planning the festivities. She's the president and CEO of Graybo Entertainment. Her organization was hired by the city to plan the festival. Also with me here in Studio A is Joe May. He's a singer from Randallstown. He was featured on the TV show The Voice, where he made it to the top 20. Joe will be performing at the African American Festival on Sunday. Welcome to you both.
Hey, how are
Thank
you?
Thank you. We're glad to be here.
Yeah, so Shalonda, 40 years.
40 years.
And this is, by some counts, the largest cultural festival on the East Coast. This is a huge deal, isn't it?
It's huge. I mean, we get record numbers not only from Baltimore, but we get people coming from all over the country. So it's amazing. The hotels are filling up, you know, so everybody is really excited about the economic impact to Baltimore.
Yeah, I mean, hundreds of thousands of people we're talking about. Yeah, that's great. So in addition to music and the kinds of performances that Joe's going to be doing, you have these various tents and stuff.
Yes.
I'm interested in some of them. One of them's called the Empowerment Tent, and it has panels and speakers and stuff. What are the kinds of topics you're going to be delving into in that place?
Oh, my God. We have some amazing topics in the Empowerment Pavilion. Not only the topics, but some amazing people. Some of our hosts are in there are Alfred Edmonds from Black Enterprise. We have Kwame Jackson. I don't know if you remember him from The Apprentice with... you know who, and then just some amazing.
I'm proud to say I actually never watched The Apprentice. Just let the record show.
I know a number of people probably are, but we have everything in the pavilion happening from financial literacy. We want to make sure that we are bringing that. We have a program called Next Level, where we're doing jobs. We have people who are coming here from the Army to WMATA, the Washington MTA, and some others. Who have jobs they want to fill immediately on site. We have some really fun relationship things. We have some people, Tara Wallace from Love and Hip Hop. She's doing some things. We have, just some amazing book signings. We have Zane. We have Matthew Knowles, who is Beyonce's dad, who's going to have his book there. So we just have some great empowerment pieces in that tent.
Can't see Beyonce, but you can see Beyonce's dad. That's pretty good. I'll take that. As a dad, I'll take that.
Absolutely.
And Joe, you're going to be playing this festival. I mean, congratulations.
Thank you.
You went deep into the field in The Voice. It would seem to me that playing a festival is tough. It's a different kind of gig mm-hmm. than a club or a concert because it's outside and people are walking around and stuff. You got to grab folks. I mean, you hit that stage and you got to make folks say, I'm gonna stop what I'm doing and check this guy out.
And there are so many different people there to see other artists that they might not necessarily be there to see you. So you do have to, like you said, grab their attention and like let them know who you are, you know, and why you're at that festival. But I'm excited.
Yeah.
I grew up, like, going to these festivals, like, since I was, like, a kid. Like, and I remember just seeing,
it's older than him.
Yeah. Like,
right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, people like Patti LaBelle have performed on this stage that I'm about to perform on. So it's, like, I'm honored. Like,
so at least you'll have some friends and family you can count on them being in the crowd.
Oh, right? Yeah. That's my
it will be well seated with folks who know you, right?
My family is definitely going to be there. They're at all the shows. So.
Yeah. You know, I mean, show business is a tough business, and mm-hmm. I'm interested and very impressed that you were on season 10 of The Voice, but you started 2 years before that.
I did. I originally auditioned season 8, and I didn't even make it to I think I went to the second audition, but I didn't actually get to audition for the producers. But it was something that I really wanted to do. Like, I'm the type of person who doesn't really take no for an answer. So just because I did audition, they told me no, it was like, no, I'm going to do this again. And I just kept going.
That's what it takes in this business, yeah. And, you know, Shalonda, I'm also interested that you have a STEM Nation.
Absolutely.
Talking about STEM, I talked to a woman who heads up the African American Studies Department at Emory University, a terrific mm-hmm. scholar named Carol Anderson. She wrote a book in which she talked about, for example, in 2004, they did not award one PhD to an African-American in the field of astronomy. Not one. Right? There were 2,100 PhDs awarded in the sciences, and none went to African-Americans 12 years ago. That has started to change a little bit. It started to tick the right direction. But STEM training and interest in the sciences and in math and in computer science, that kind of thing, very important for any community.
Extremely important. I'm actually an electrical engineer by degree. And the person that's heading up this tent for us, Al Sweets, really, he brought the idea to us a few years ago. So we've always had STEM probably for the last
4 years, I think, at the festival. But companies like EMC that are committed to it, colleges like Morgan State University, similar to Emory, understand that that's the differentiator, especially for the African-American community, because that's where you can really start to open doors and create opportunities for, you know, economic parity. And so, but we want to make it fun. So when you go into STEM Nation, they have unmanned aerial systems. The kids are doing robot building and just different fun, engaging experiences to get everybody at all levels excited about STEM.
Yeah. And of course, you know, it works the same way with music. If you get a bunch of folks catching your act, you know, at the festival, it creates a buzz. And it, the same thing works for STEM. I mean, you can create a buzz about science. You can create a buzz about, you know, continuing your education in the engineering field. Of course, Joe, the Baltimore music community lost a young man this weekend who was so highly thought of, so had such a bright future. I ran by the stage name of Laura Scuda. Mm-hmm. His name was Tyrese Trayvon Watson. Yep. Gunned down on the streets. I mean, another, you know, terrible, sad story. Did you know him? Or did you know his music at all?
No, I didn't know him personally. Yeah. I was a little familiar with his music, and I knew other people who you know, were affiliated with him and who knew him.
Because it's interesting how, you know, the outpouring of grief and the outpouring of support for his family and for his music. I mean, absolutely. Last night they were, you know, literally dancing on Pennsylvania Avenue over by North Avenue, the CVS, because, you know, he was a very popular young man. Mm-hmm. The music scene in Baltimore is pretty vibrant, isn't it? I mean, mm-hmm. you grew up in it, you know, have been a big part of it, and you're one of the few people who has a national profile because of your appearances on television. But what's your take on how the music scene in Baltimore is doing these days?
I think it's doing pretty good. I'm excited to initially, when I started music, I wasn't, you know, super involved in the Baltimore music scene. I did a lot of stuff in D.C. But since I've come home, it's been exciting to, you know, get more involved in the music scene. I've worked with, you know, different people in the area, and I'm excited about it.
And it's no longer the case that, you know, to have a career in music, you got to go to New York or L.A. or Atlanta,
no,
Chicago.
I think,
you can do it from here, right?
Yeah, I think with social media, you can do those things. You can, you know, you can be based in Baltimore and you can, you know, still travel and, you know, put your music out there, but you don't have to necessarily be in those. It's important to go to those cities, though.
Well, break a leg at the festival this weekend.
Thank you
both
so much.
Really, that's what we say in show business, you know, and I appreciate both of you guys coming in. Thanks.
Thank you.
Shalonda Stokes is the president and CEO of Graybo Entertainment. That's the group producing the African American Festival. Joe May is a singer from Randallstown. He was featured on the TV show The Voice. He made it to the top 20. He'll be performing at the festival on Sunday. The festival takes place this weekend. Camden Yards, concerts, and activities are all free. It starts noon on Saturday. For a list of events and entertainers, you can visit our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today. Coming up Wednesday, Undoing Racism, starting new conversations about race across the country and what it takes to address and fix an old and complex issue like bigotry. Plus, Jessica Anya Blau on her steamy new novel, The Trouble with Lexi. Until then, for Nathan Sterner and the entire Maryland Morning team, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.